to gently close down the eyes. And it's quite helpful just to turn the gaze downwards, just beyond the nose, allowing our beautiful eyes to rest. We've all been busy racing around today. It's the end of the working week. And now is the time to relax. The time to come into peace. So sitting quietly in this beautiful Dharma hall this evening, become aware of this place that you sit, this place that you breathe. Become aware of the space around you. This beautiful collection of people with a goodness of heart coming together to share in practice. And as you quieten and settle, starting to become aware of the sounds around us. The sounds in the room, the gentle hum of the air conditioners, the sounds of life, of our fellow beings in the room. And gently allowing those sounds to come into our field of awareness, noticing the way they arise, they exist, and then they change. So we don't hang on to the sounds or wish for them to be any different. Just simply acknowledging their arising and passing. As we become settled and at peace, and starting to listen really deeply to the sound of our own breathing. Throughout our day, we become so busy, we forget to breathe, forget to stop. And appreciate the silence within, the beauty of our breath. So listening, feeling the breath arising and passing. And just like sounds arise and pass, just like we inhale and exhale, taking a moment to become aware of any thoughts in the mind, the movements of mind. And being aware, we'll always be thinking, it's just what we do. But stop doing start noticing. Notice the arising of thought, the thoughts that take form and exist, and then pass, always changing. Sounds, breath, thoughts. Arising and passing, just like the clouds. And having placed ourselves, beginning to know that we're sitting, know that we're breathing, beginning to see things as they are, we become aware of our body, mindfulness of body, this body that carries us throughout the day. This body that rests. Becoming aware of the sensation of sitting. Feeling the contact with the earth. And just doing a brief scan. Crown of the head, the back of the head, the shoulders, the forearms, the hands and fingers. The upper back, the lower back, the buttocks and hips, sitting comfortably, the upper legs, the knees, the lower legs, the feet, feeling the contact between the feet and the floor, contact with the earth. The feet grounding into the earth. Feeling the face, the eyes, the mouth, maybe even bringing a smile to the face, feeling the softness of the cheeks, the softness of the jaw, the throat, where we speak our truth, our heart space, becoming aware of the body of the breath, the rise of the chest, the falling away with the out-breath. Breathing. Moving down to the tummy. Feeling the rise and fall of the belly. Pelvis. The arms. The legs. Feeling down into the feet. Returning to the earth. Mindfulness of the body. The body that sits upon this earth. Held. Cradled. At peace. Breathing in, breathing out. Nowhere to be, nothing to do, just being here now. Sinking. Deep below the thinking mind, into the heart space. And listening. Listening deeply. Feeling deeply. Feeling the sensations of the heart space. And accepting whatever emotions, whatever feelings may arise, just as they are. Second factor of mindfulness, mindfulness of feelings and sensations. And with a warm and open and gracious heart, allowing our awareness to come down into the belly, feeling into the belly, feeling this whole body of breath. feeling its very visceral nature. Accepting, seeing things just as they are. Feeling the space within, feeling the space around. And beginning to look even deeper. Beginning to look into our own mind, our own heart mind. Letting go with every out-breath. Breathing in awareness with every in-breath. A clear, calm presence. Mindfulness of mind. Seeing things just as they are. Breathing in, breathing out, knowing that you're sitting, knowing that you're breathing. Seeing things just as they are. And coming into truth. Coming into the Dharma. sounds arise. They exist, they pass. Thoughts arise, they exist, they pass. Sensations arise, exist, and pass. Seeing things just as they are. Heart space opens, becomes soft. Clear mind, soft heart, seeing things just as they are. Knowing that you're sitting, knowing that you're breathing, resting in the heart space, resting in your own truth. Now let go of the meditator. Let go of any holding on, any craving, any clinging. And just let the meditation happen. And simply notice that you are noticing. Being here now. In a few moments, I'll start to bring the meditation to a close. Just catch your reaction. Let go. Notice that you are noticing. As you start to breathe just a little bit deeper. Breathing into the heart space. Whole body breathing. Whole body at peace. Breathing just a little bit deeper, letting go just a little bit more, opening that heart, breathing in awareness. Breathing out love, kindness, compassion. Starting to become aware of the space around us, the space within us. Maybe starting to move the fingers and toes just a little bit. Feeling our inherent goodness, our vitality. And breathing all the way in completely. Letting go completely. And I'll start to sound the bell. It's keeping your eyes closed to the end of the third ring. with the eyes closed, just rubbing your hands together, nice and warm. And bringing them into your heart and saying a gentle thank you to yourself for taking this time to meditate. And if it feels right to do so, maybe dedicating your practice to someone in need of a bit of kindness and care right now. May they be well. May they be at peace. And gently opening the eyes, turning to the people next to you and saying thank you to them too. And welcome. Yeah. Welcome to everybody in the room.
Welcome to Dhammaloka, everyone. My name's Bill Coons. I'm the events coordinator. Sandra has already ably introduced herself. next Friday night is the last Friday where we have a guest speaker or a guest event, and that will be a Bai Yan event led by Sai Young. Adults Australia Community Group. Bayans are devotional songs that produce spiritual vibrations and lead to great joy both on those who sing and on those who hear the songs. This coming Sunday, there's a Kusala Hermitage fundraiser at Dhammaloka, starting at about 10 a.m. And then there'll be a Katina ceremony for Bodhinyana at Jhana Grove on the 24th, and another Katina at Dhammasara for the nuns on the 31st of October. So Ajahn Brahm returns to Dhammaloka for the Friday night, 22nd of October. Ajahn Brahm will be visiting Nanup and Margaret River on the 31st of October. Please see website for events. And Dhammaloka subcommittee is seeking volunteers for the position of volunteer coordinator, gardening coordinator, and other volunteers. Please contact me or admin@bswa.org. And introduction to meditation will be on tomorrow, session number 2, starting at 3 p.m. to 4:15 p.m. And there's also meditation for more accomplished meditators in this hall, from 3 till 4. And for anyone visiting Albany Hermitage, please ensure to call 98446666 and speak to Venerable Mudu or email greatsudden@bswa.org. Please do not follow Google Maps instructions, as they may take you to a neighbouring property and the neighbours are sick and tired of telling people where to go. Okay, thank you.
Fair enough.
And Sandra, over to you again.
Okay, well, so tonight's talk, I'd like to talk a little bit about wisdom at work. And what happens when you put a whole lot of people together, each with their own histories, their own triumphs, their vulnerabilities, and attempt to rationalize an inherently irrational collection of hearts and minds kind of sums up the modern workforce. So this talk is about how we take our practice in our everyday life, how we take our practice into our everyday life and our work environments, and most importantly, how we can use the Buddha's teachings to survive the tale. So I remember when I was growing up, I grew up in Narajin, a country town, a couple of hundred k's from here. And growing up on the farm, I always thought the logical trajectory was going to be to study hard, stay out of trouble, get a good job, fit in, follow the rules, find a good person to marry, fit in, produce what society expects of me. Don't ruffle too many feathers along the way. Establish a long and rewarding career and then retire. The key to success was to keep life neatly compartmentalized. It was a bit of a buzzword a while back. Don't allow too much drift. And don't disclose personal feelings. Stay happy, or at least give the impression that you're happy. Fake it till you make it. That way, no one gets disappointed and no one gets hurt. Or as Jon Kabat-Zinn puts it, we're living the full catastrophe. So I'm not sure, there was a lot of fitting in there, but I'm not sure where belonging came into the equation. And there were certainly a lot of times that I felt I didn't belong. Country or city, a job that pays well or a job that chases a dream. Do I fit in? Do I belong? Do I even care? What really drives me on? I never thought I would see the world through my studies, have such a variety of jobs, find myself sitting in a Buddhist temple in Sri Lanka, and eventually be drawn to meet my husband at Dharmaloka. As Joan Didion says, I lost a few people along the way. I never thought I would find myself introducing mindfulness concepts into a work environment, which now sees me lead weekly meditation classes. I never thought I'd stand up and do a welcome to country, speaking Noongar language. The world of work certainly has changed. Wonju wonju, Noonarkot. Welcome, welcome, everybody. I never saw myself being invited to coordinate the BSWA care group and sit on this dais and talk with you. It's been quite the journey. It's essentially been a story of learning to belong and to be held, to be welcomed, rather than just fitting in. So now, I can sit on the dais here and talk with you and say I've been guiding meditation classes in the community and my workplace for about 3 years now. So every Wednesday, I sit down with my workmates and we meditate, either in person or online. We have people all over the state tune in. It's quite amazing. It's been great to see people come together and enjoy some peace, to be vulnerable, and most of all, set the tone for a friendlier, more connected community. Our numbers waver with the weather, and the group ebbs and flows in numbers. It's a fascinating barometer that doesn't seem to follow any rhyme nor reason. But it has one key ingredient, and that is belonging. Now, This is where, for me, the collision between fitting in and belonging really comes to the fore, and where the challenges of applying wisdom at work really come in. It is also where the friction between community, corporate, and individual values arise. So this month is Mental Health Month, hot on the heels of Are You OK Day, great source of morning teas. So employees at my workplace are being encouraged to take the happiness challenge. And this is based on a TED talk and research by a chap called Sean Anker. And Sean is one of the world's leading experts on the connection between happiness and success. He claims that happiness isn't just about feeling good, it's about the joy we feel while striving after our potential. Now note the word striving. Happiness is actually an individual choice, even in the midst of negative circumstances. It's not something our employers can give us, though they can limit and influence that choice. And you could sub-employer out for family, relatives, etc. And I really had to utter a bit of a uncomfortable laugh at the quote of the day today. Caring for myself is not self-indulgence, it is self-preservation, and that is an act of political warfare. That's a line from Audre Lorde, an African-American poet and activist. An act of political warfare. But really, is the personal really political? So suggested activities to evoke happiness as part of the happiness challenge are as follows. This is the script. Write down three things we are grateful for. Now, I've kept a gratitude diary for a number of years, and it's quite a helpful thing to do. Send a positive message to someone. Journal our most meaningful experience of the last 24 hours. And you'll have a chuckle at this. Meditate 2 minutes per day. All you need, 2 minutes. Breathe in, breathe out. Exercise for 15 minutes. So the list is pretty good. These are all laudable things to be doing to look after health and well-being. But will they actually lead to lasting happiness? Is the struggle real? Is it really a personal warfare? In the background, the workplace is undergoing a seismic shift, and many workplaces are doing this, building programs of corporate well-being to meet their commitment to mentally safe workplaces. There are training programs around empathy, adopting a growth mindset, and building buoyancy and resilience. The struggle is real. And, you know, given that we dedicate so many of our waking hours and productive years to work, it makes sense to ensure a more human-friendly work environment. You know, it's certainly a far cry from the late 1800s, when we saw coal workers fighting for ventilation in the coal mines to prevent black lung. Now we seem to be fighting to preserve our sanity in our minds. Nonetheless, the sceptical Buddhist in me asks, in this world where we seemingly have everything at our fingertips, including opportunities for work and education, why and how did the teaching of compassion and empathy become a thing? How did the modern work environment tilt so far? How far can a pendulum really swing? And when did self-care become part of the lexicon? And how did corporate wellness become rationalized as a bottom line measure? And this is where it gets a bit interesting. So the Global Wellness Institute has estimated the workplace wellness market to be worth around $48 billion. The total global wellness economy being worth $4.5 trillion, which is actually growing faster than the global economy itself. Within this mix, spiritual self-care is one of the numerous spin-offs of this rapidly expanding industry. So in Australia, the corporate wellness market is predicted to grow to around $330 million. And one of the reasons for investment, for putting these corporate wellness programs in place, is that the direct cost to employers of absenteeism due to workplace stress is around $16 billion a year, or according to the ABS, around $2,700 per employee. So it's a big cost. And when you put it that way, that $330 million is probably a low level of investment, especially once you take the government subsidies away. So despite all of this effort, when it boils down, only 5% of employees actually access formal employee assistance programs. The mental health issues continue to be one of the leading causes of disability and illness in the workplace, and yet the global wellness market booms. It's like this Orwellian universe of Fitbits, apps, online Zoom classes, and all manner of happiness trackers. And it kind of, the penny dropped for me when I read this comment by someone in the Harvard Business Review, one of the employees of these companies that had invested heavily in wellness programs. And he said, company bulletins emphasize that these things are intended to offset work stress, but at the same time, they obliquely reinforce the idea that work stress is the inherent byproduct of being good at what you do and working hard at it. It's some kind of normal. And when I look at this, I can see there is suffering. I can see there is a cause of suffering. But how does it end? So research continues to show that workplace culture is the biggest roadblock employees face in their efforts to feel happier and healthier in their lives. The interesting thing, though, is when I took my workmates off to the coffee shop yesterday and we sat down with a cuppa away from the office, there was no shortage of suggestions on how to turn this around. Without the load of piffle that goes with it. And it really boiled down to four things. And it was to accept that mental health is just that. It's a continuum of well to unwell. Or as my friend kindly put it, some people are not well all the time. We all have crap days. It arises and it passes. It's not always a label you wear. You aren't depression, you aren't anxiety. Life goes up, life goes down. Sometimes we need a bit more help. But I feel there's an issue. Some people, we just aren't well all the time. And that's okay. Flexible workplace policies. You know, trust us a little and you'll get commitment back. And that's where it's been really positive with COVID-19, with the remote working arrangements. What actually happened was we proved to our employees that we can be trustworthy. a lot of us actually worked really hard working remotely. Leaders showing compassion, encouraging employees to bring their full self to work. Not only our talents and our gifts, but our foibles and our vulnerabilities as well. Or put more simply, we're all human. Creating spaces for people to be emotionally available, helping and offering support to others. It's not so compartmentalised nowadays. You can be vulnerable. Sometimes it's just as simple as saying hello, having a chat and a water cooler. Great source of information, I find. The bike shed, the coffee line, the communal kitchen area. That's where you find out what's really happening. So these suggestions are not that far off the four Brahma Viharas in spirit. There's the uptake of metta, friendliness and kindness. There's karuna, compassion. Maybe there's even a little bit of mudita, vicarious joy. I'm not so sure we're close to a state of equanimity or upekkha just yet. So if that is really all it takes, then why is it so hard? And that's where we start to question ourselves a little bit deeper. Maybe we just like having the grit in there. It appeals to our competitive spirit and our irrational nature. Maybe we like that the struggle is real. It seems inherent that we always want to be someone different. But again, how much of this is about just simply fitting in, and how much closer does it bring to us feeling a sense of belonging? And back to the workplace, I always have a bit of a chuckle. We have this employee experience survey. It comes out every year or so. And there's this question in there, do your colleagues know the real you? And I ask myself, do I know the real me? Does anyone know the real me? Does anyone know the real them? So the journey of discovering and bringing my full self to the workplace has been somewhat illuminating. It's been a pretty interesting exercise in balancing the work speak with my Buddhist training. So every few years, organisations wanting to create a cultural shift introduce new personality type assessments, rolled out at team building days or corporate talent management initiatives. I've undertaken a number of these throughout my career, and there's always something to learn about the nature of conditioning and perception, and there's always the uncomfortable feeling of, do I fit in? Do I actually belong? So my first foray into this was the Myers-Briggs assessment. So I sat down, I answered all the questions, and I was soon categorised as an INTJ. Apparently, the type is an architect, the person with the introverted, intuitive, thinking and judging personality traits. I was described as a thoughtful tactician that loves perfecting the details of life, applying creativity and rationality to everything I do. However, they did note my inner world is often a private, complex one. Years later, the ground shifted, and with a new workplace came a new assessment, this time the team management system. Again, I diligently went through a rigorous assessment of my conditioning and I was categorised again. I was an upholder, a maintainer, a reporter, an advisor, an explorer, a promoter. I was known as a split wheel. Apparently that's quite rare. My last two forays have been with a print profiling tool. In 2016, I was a fresh-faced 3-4. I was driven to succeed and thrive, to be special and find meaning in life. And then, after a run of annual meditation retreats and some soul searching, and quite a bit of vipassana, I decided to let it all go. Now I'm a little more silver. And this time I was categorized as a 7-9. And I was pretty happy with this outcome this time. I had a view to enjoy life and be happy, to have peace and harmony. Can't argue with that. So, with that, another thing I never thought I would do is read the whole of Proust. So I'd like to quote Proust, In Search of Lost Time. Our social personality is created by the thoughts of other people. Even the simple act which we describe as seeing someone we know is to some extent an intellectual process. We pack the physical outline of the creature we see with all the ideas we have already formed about them, and in the complete picture of them which we compose in our minds, those ideas have certainly the principal place. And then we believe that we can change the things around us in accordance with our desires. We believe it because otherwise we can see no favourable outcome. We do not think of the outcome which generally comes to pass and is also favourable. We do not succeed in changing things in accordance with our desires, but gradually our desires change. So it's very common for us to come to Buddhist practices, particularly in the West, with very strong notions of who we are or the kind of person we'd like to be. I'm this sort of person. I want to be that sort of person. Buddhism, through the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, helps us to appreciate who we are rather than to become somebody we are not, to let go of the struggle and the striving to tap into our own wisdom. And as meditators, we know it's only when we let go that we can come close to feeling welcome and accept an invitation to belong. And in order to feel that warm embrace of belonging, maybe we need to take the advice of the Buddha, put aside such investigations into self, and instead just look at the opportunities we have right here, right now, for thinking, acting, and speaking in more skillful ways. This can only be a good thing for shifting the focus away from the individual and recognizing our belonging as part of a community. Or maybe it's as New York author and mindfulness teacher Tracy Cochran suggests, notice that you notice you are here. Stand back, let go. So I'm going to run through a few ideas that I picked up and teachings I picked up. And there's six areas I wanted to cover off on in this last half hour. First of all, recognize the value of peace and make it real. Ask yourself, do you value peace? It's hard to value what you don't want. Now, this requires a lot of honesty. And when we find ourselves entering into conflict, it may be that we place value on the struggle rather than peace. We believe the struggle is real. Remember, self-righteous indignation can really be quite addictive. We don't really want peace, otherwise we would choose it. Perhaps the reason is that we still think that conflict gives us something, that the struggle is real and we need to struggle in order to grow. We know that there will be challenges and those difficult people and circumstances, but what we crave more than peace is to be acknowledged and respected. power and respect are critical to our self-worth. We all want to be liked after all. We don't want to appear weak. We want to appear strong. We think that resistance is strength. After all, we've been working on our story and our status for quite some time. And why would we give up the struggle now? Eventually, though, we realise that we've suffered enough. We are tired of living the full catastrophe. We realise that peace is the only real and only platform. Peace is the real and only platform. It is the power of our values that drives our perceptions and interprets the way we see the world. Our behaviour and response follows our pre-chosen routes. In other words, we need right understanding to pre-program right thought, right action and right effort. They're not just the signposts flashing in the rearview mirror. Or as we would put it in Buddhist terms, we are heir to our own deeds. And to borrow from Christian teachings, remember, it's the meek that inherit the earth. And secondly, again, coming back to the Four Noble Truths, be skillful, skill up. This is where we shift our attention to more useful questions around the Four Noble Truths. More useful than this relentless investigation of self. These truths give you a way of looking at experience that focuses directly on the issue of skillfulness. The Buddha was really quite clear. In other words, we might look at our experiences in terms of four variables: cause and effect on one hand, skillful and unskillful on the other. The first noble truth, the truth of suffering and stress, that's an unskillful result. The unskillful cause is craving and ignorance. On the other side, you've got the path of practice. That's a skillful cause with the cessation of suffering as its result. We can read deeper. So some insight on how we may spend our life can be gained from the discourses, particularly the one on recollection. And this is where Mahanama, a devoted follower from one of the local villages, goes up to the Buddha and says to him, "Sir, I've heard that several mendicants are making a robe for the Buddha, thinking that when his robe was finished and the 3 months of the rains residence had passed, the Buddha would set out wandering." He was a bit sceptical about this. He said, "Now, we spend our life in various ways. Which of these should we practice?" And the answer from the Buddha was, "Good, good, Mahanama. It's appropriate that gentlemen such as you come to me and ask, we spend our life in various ways. Which of these should we practice? The faithful succeed, not the faithless. The energetic succeed, not the lazy. The mindful succeed, not the unmindful. Those with immersion succeed, not those without immersion. The wise succeed, not the witless." The third, don't become a stick in the mud. And for this, I refer, I kid you not, the Billabong Sutta. Quite apt for an Australian audience. And it took me a while to understand this one. But the Buddha suggests there are four types of people found in this world. And the teaching asks us to consider our intentions. So do we seek identification and hold on and become stuck? Or do we choose to break through our ignorances, let go and become free? And he describes these four people. And you'll have to Just bear with the language a bit. So the first person enters and he remains in a peaceful release of the heart. He focuses on the cessation, the ending of identification. But his mind isn't eager. It's not confident, settled, or decided. So you wouldn't expect him to stop identifying. If he were to grab a branch with a glue-smeared hand, it would stick. He would hold on. He would bind to it. He'd become stuck. It's like holding on to your story. You become stuck. The second person enters, and again, with that peaceful release of the heart, they too are focusing on the ending of identification. But their mind is eager. They are confident, settled, and decided about it. They've set a course, plugged it into the GPS. You would expect them to stop identifying. And if they were to grab a branch with their clean hand, their hand wouldn't stick. They wouldn't be holding on. They'd be letting go. So that's the first two people. Now the second two people, the third and fourth. So the third person enters and remains again in that peaceful release of the heart, and they focus on smashing ignorance. But their mind isn't committed. They're not eager. They're not confident or settled. So you wouldn't expect them to succeed. And this is equated to the billabong. So you imagine a billabong that's been stagnant for many years. And if someone was to close off the inlets and open up the drains and the heavens didn't provide enough rain, you wouldn't expect that billabong to break its banks. So I guess what he's saying there is if we remain closed in ignorance, we can't break free. We can't be fulfilled. The fourth person, they come in, again with that joyful heart, they focus on smashing ignorance. And their mind is eager, they are confident, they are settled, they are quite decided about it. Now you would expect that person to smash ignorance. And again we come to the billabong. So again, the billabong, stagnant for many years. Now if someone was to open up the inlets, close off the drains, and heavens provided plenty of rains, you'd expect that billabong to break its banks. You'd expect that person to feel a sense of freedom, a sense of release and letting go. And I move to the fourth idea. So with that open mind, that open heart, slow down, be present. We are constantly surrounded by speed and aggression. We've always got to get things done. To say, I'm just going to slow down, can be quite countercultural in some senses, especially in the workplace. No time for sitting around drinking tea. But what I've noticed myself is when you do start to slow down, and approach life with a bit more peace, other people start to notice and they pick it up. It's the fact that you start showing up and you're really there with people. You're showing up for work and life in a way that you may not have before, and they pick up on that. And that's what starts to create a different culture. And it just reminds me, I advertise my meditation sessions on Meetup. And there's 137 people on this group. But I'm never likely to meet more than 15 or 20 of them. No. People hit a like, they join, they don't show up. It's a really interesting phenomena of modern times. the fear fairy asks the hard questions, but with an attitude of right speech. So interestingly, this advice is from the teachings on resentment, which I've paired with the teachings on right speech. So sometimes we're too scared to question. We think we have to be a good Buddhist. Keep it calm. Don't question. Don't upset anyone. Don't ruffle those feathers. But here is some advice from the suttas on asking questions, courtesy of Venerable Sariputta. And he addresses his fellow monks, friend monks. Whoever asks a question of another does so for one or other of these five reasons. What five? Number one, it's pretty harsh, some of these, the language in these suttas. Number one, stupidity and folly. Number two, wicked desires, being naturally full of desires. Three, to disparage. Then we start to get a bit more positive. Four, wanting to understand. Five, asking with the thought, if they correctly answer the question I ask, it's good. If not, I'll correctly answer it for them. Now, this is where I do disagree a bit. This was Sariputta's preferred response. I'm not sure we should be answering questions for people. We should let them speak. So from the Book of Fives, it suggests that before we question others, we first establish five things in ourselves. Speak at the right time, not at the wrong time. Speak truthfully, not falsely. Gently, not harshly. Beneficially, not harmfully. Lovingly, not from secret hate. Which brings me to sit back and listen. And it's not inconsequential that many of the Buddha's teachings started with the words, "Thus I have heard." The Buddha emphasized the importance of listening in his earliest teachings and methods, and he didn't actually write a single word of his sermons during his lifetime. He only spoke them. And for centuries, all of those teachings were transferred orally. And it was only around the first century that Sri Lankan Buddhists committed to the Buddha's teachings started to write them down and started to codify them in suttas or sayings of the Buddha. And when you go onto Sutta Central, which is a good source for reading the suttas, there's several suttas specifically dedicated to listening well. And in amongst all of this, the Buddha gives five benefits for listening, which are kind of fairly obvious, but it's worth reminding ourselves of them. So one hears what one has not heard before. One clarifies what one has heard before. One gets rid of doubt. One views are made straight. And one's mind grows serene. That's the beauty of listening. Which takes me to another point. Make time to care. And our spiritual leader, Ajahn Brahm, often advises us to ask the Emperor's three questions when considering what's most important in life. And I'm sure we've all heard this before. So, when is the most important time? Correct, now. Who are the most important people? Yeah, love the one you're with. What is the most important thing to do? To care. It's so simple. But how many times do we find ourselves at a meeting or at the dinner table and we're just so keen to get our story out? We just want to be heard. We're not actually listening to anything the other person is saying. We're just so engaged with our story, with fitting in. We don't give the other person a chance to belong. So make time to care, to listen. And I'd like to finish off with one more theme. And that's opening up to good fortune. And I'll read it out to you. I won't read the full teaching because it's rather long, but I pulled out some pertinent parts for this talk. Many gods and humans desiring well-being are seekers of good fortune. Please tell me the greatest good fortune. And the Buddha says, not to associate with fools, but to associate with the wise. And to honour those worthy of honour, this is the greatest good fortune. To live in a suitable place, having previously done good karma, and to apply oneself in the right way, this is the greatest good fortune. To be educated and to have a vocation, to be well trained in one's chosen field, and to speak words that are well spoken, this is the greatest good fortune. To support one's mother and father, to cherish one's partner and children, and to have a job without stress, this is the greatest good fortune. A mind that remains unshaken by the ups and downs of the world, sorrowless, stainless, and safe. This is the greatest good fortune. Having performed these things, nowhere can they be conquered. They are secure wherever they go. This is their greatest good fortune. So I'd like to end the talk there. Just let us ponder the good teachings, how we can take wisdom into our everyday life and our work, not just fitting in but belonging. So I thank you all for listening, and we've got a good 10 minutes or so left, so if anyone would like to ask a question or offer a comment, share, please feel free.
I have a question.
Yeah, by all means.
Thank you for the talk. It was very stimulating for me. My question,
You started talking about the corporate wellness programs, etc. Do you think there's a danger that mindfulness is becoming watered down, diluted, in these types of programs, in that people think that they are learning mindfulness perhaps when really without any dedicated kind of practice, and they might miss an opportunity to go deeper.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. I think that's one of the real dangers. I mean, when I look online and I look at something like Insight Timer, the last time I looked, there was 90,000 meditations on there. Highly variable. And what I found delivering meditation in the workplace, you've got to be quite upfront about it. Most of the time it's a relaxation class. And that's the way I tend to pitch it. So I think it's a matter of not pretending that it's something it isn't. So what I found with the meditators at work is they're quite proud of the fact that they meditate. And they'll all come into the room and they'll lie down and make themselves comfortable. And it's a bit of a joke going with some of them. They think it's adult nap time. And, and you know, I started off trying to, you know, I try to inject messages of mindfulness and try to introduce some teachings, but you've got to be pretty vanilla in the workplace. But yeah, I see your point, I really do. I mean, next Tuesday I'll spend the whole day at our Balcatta office and I'll be teaching the... I'm just going to teach basic breath techniques to the call centre workers. So we'll do little 10-minute meditations, breathing in, breathing out, becoming aware of the breath and body. That's as far as we'll go. And we'll do half an hour at lunchtime. But yeah, it does worry me to an extent, that real commercialization of mindfulness. And what you've got to remember is there's, you know, I met with this wonderful lady this morning who's, she's setting up a thing called the Recovery College. And what she was saying is that a lot of the workplace programs, it's really still aimed at that concept of fitting in, aimed at the individual. It's not, yeah, that doesn't really go to that depth of building real belonging. We're meeting our requirements to provide a safe workplace. We've got these programs in place. And yes, a lot of people get a lot of benefit out of that. But it's never going to be deep teaching.
Yeah, I suppose a comment would be, I guess it's probably good that people are being exposed to mindfulness.
Yeah.
And that's a positive and it is becoming mainstream, and then it's kind of down to the whoever's facilitating to or leading the groups to... Yeah, I mean, depending where they're coming from, and they could perhaps link people with other resources if they wanted to get more deep teaching.
Oh, totally. And people will seek it out. And that's what I found, is that once people have a taste of it, they have a taste of that stillness and the benefits it brings, they'll naturally start to search. And, you know, they'll come here or they'll turn up on a Wednesday night to the to our care group meditations. They might ring the care line. They actively seek it out. But it's, you know, they just need to have the door open for them a little. Yeah.
And thank you for your work with the care line.
You're welcome. We have some wonderful volunteers. They really are amazing people. Anyone else got any questions or questions from online? I think the live chat's probably going.
Actually, when you organize the meditation at work, did anybody come to you and say, no, I don't want that because I am of another, I follow another religion?
Yes,
and I do not want Buddhism, so how do you deal with that?
That was quite funny, actually. And it's the reason why I was saying that you need to keep it pretty secular in the workplace. I was a couple of years ago it happened now, and I was doing the lunchtime meditation session, and I've always been a bit nervous with wearing my faith on my sleeve. And so I sort of introduced, we're doing an Anapanasati meditation. So I sometimes do Anapanasati style meditation, sometimes a metta meditation. And I was just explaining to people where it came from. And I could see this lady becoming quite agitated. And she said to me afterwards, she said, "Oh, when you mentioned Buddhism, I thought I needed to run out of the room." I said, "Why?" She goes, "Oh, because I'm a devout Christian and that's not stuff I should be listening to." And I said, "Oh, okay." And we had a chat about it and it ended quite well. And I said, "Well, you know, really at the end of the day, it's about being a good person, a good human being. And, you know, Ashram Brahm, who's the abbot down at Serpentine Monastery, he's really good friends with the abbot at New Norcia Monastery. And once a year, I'm not sure if they still do this, but they have an interfaith bus tour. They go and look at all the other faiths. And I always remember Ajahn Brahm saying that, you know, when he goes to a church or to New Norcia Monastery, he'll pay respects and vice versa. And yeah, like it's, and also the other really penny dropping moment for me was when Ajahn Brahm explained that, you know, Buddhism, it's, you sort of have to get away from the label, but it's a realization. It's not, I mean, sure, there's a, in particularly in the East, there's a lot of ritual and a lot of ceremony around it, but it's really a realization. And that's, for me, what the meditation is about. And when I explained that to her, she was okay with that. And and nowadays, when I sit at work and I lead the meditation, I'll have, and I like to dip in and borrow from a few different faiths, because I know that some of the people in my group, they might be Hindu, there's the occasional Muslim person who comes along, there's other people who are, you know, they don't subscribe to a faith at all. But at the end of the day, we're all just trying to be good human beings. And that's what I base the meditations on. So that was a bit of a rambly answer, but yeah. All right, does anyone else have any questions, any curiosities? If not, we'll call it a night. It's 9 o'clock on the big red clock at the back. And we'll finish by paying our respects to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. So if it feels right, you can, you know, bow to the Buddha, the one who was awakened, the Dharma, the truth, the Sangha, those who practice well.